We do have a next issue, which is the Department of Forestry and Department of Environmental Quality collaboration. So we'll continue that theme. Okay, thanks.
Chair Imason, board member, State Forest Authority. For the record, my name is Kyle Abraham and I serve as the Private Forest Division Chief. Good to see you again this afternoon. So this is a good segue from the air quality to the water quality conversations that we're having with DEQ. As you may remember for background, part of this process was born out of the Siskiyou Streamside Protection Review. So the board chose to evaluate sufficiency of rules for protecting stream temperature and stream stand structure for riparian desired future conditions in the Siskiyou georegion. Our current focus is on the expanded literature review, and we did work with ODFW and DEQ to provide contextual information on fish status and trends and water quality information from the TMDL. So you may remember that conversation, I think, from January of 2019. Following that work, the board directed the department to formulate a range of approaches to study sufficiency of the rules, including additional work with DEQ and a further evaluation of total maximum daily loads. So this sort of was the nexus of our collaboration work. And this work is mutual. ODF and DEQ are working together currently to bring TMDL, total maximum daily load, I will try not to say that acronym, at the request of the state forester, to the July board meeting where we are planning to ask the board to make a sufficiency decision using the expanded literature review and include the total maximum daily load information in a meaningful way. And it's also important to note that this work is also important in a larger context. That is to say that it was born out of the Siskiyou process, and this work will inform the Siskiyou rule sufficiency decision, but this work will also continue past that to the rest of the state where DEQ is redoing, I believe it's 14 temperature TMDLs. And so that will likely have some connection to ODF as the designated management agency when they work on the total maximum daily loads and the implementation plans. And so today, Jennifer Weigel, the Deputy Water Quality Administrator with DEQ, who has been a crucial part of our collaboration effort to date, is here, and she's going to do a little bit deeper dive into some of the process that they work through, some of the data that they have, and how that informs their process, and ultimately how that informs the process that we're going through for the Siskiyou. So I'll turn it over to Jennifer, unless there's any immediate questions.
Right ahead.
All right, good afternoon. Chair Imason, State Forester Doherty, and the other members of the board. Thanks for having me here along with Kyle to give you some updates about where we are with the collaborative work that DEQ and ODF is doing. As Kyle mentioned, based on our discussions to date, we thought that it could be a useful way to spend a little bit of additional time talking, kind of doing some sharing some information about how DEQ approaches its water quality programs, some of the data and information, give you some illustrative examples of the kinds of data and information that get brought into those processes, how we use that in the TMDL development process, and then how do we know, how do we gauge the progress and success of implementation? So how do we use data and information, and how do we approach that process? So we don't have lots of time today, so my intent is to give you kind of a high level description, and knowing that this is an ongoing conversation. So if there's something that in particular that piques people's interest or something like that, we can talk about how to ensure that it resides in the appropriate place in these conversations. Again, for the record, my name is Jennifer Weigel. I'm the Deputy Water Quality Administrator at DEQ, and I'm going to try to follow Kyle's lead and minimize my use of acronyms. I'll try real hard. Okay, so
you don't have to spell out TMDL every time you mention it.
Thank you, Chair Imason. That will speed us along a little bit. Thank you. Okay. So just to start with just a little bit of framing, I'm not going to spend a lot of time here, but often when we talk about our Clean Water Act programs, we use a schematic, something like this, just to illustrate the high-level relationships between the different elements of the Clean Water Act. So just in most basic terms, we set in-stream standards, so desired descriptions of desired water quality, rivers, streams, lakes, estuaries, et cetera. We use monitoring data and information to understand whether or not those standards are being attained. If they're not, we identify them as impaired. You may also hear them referred to as our 303D list. Those are a couple of terms that get used. For waters that are identified as impaired, we're required to develop a TMDL, which is basically a plan to get from where we are to where we need to be to achieve those water quality standards. And then when we talk about TMDL implementation, we kind of identify a fork in the road for how we treat different types of sources. Those that obtain permits from us, it's a very kind of mechanical process, basically. That gets translated into explicit permit requirements that are based on those allocations in the TMDL. For non-point sources, we have lots of diversity in how we work with those various entities to achieve those allocations. Everything from it could be counties in terms of how they manage county lands and roads and parks to working with our sister agencies like Department of Agriculture and Forestry through their water quality programs, as well as the federal land management agencies and working through their federal land management programs and how they demonstrate and plan for implementation of TMDLs. So I just wanted to talk a little bit and start by illustrating the water quality standards. So here, this is, I know mostly we're focused on the road, but for simplicity, I had this schematic available for my staff and thought this could be useful. So you can just observe that within any particular watershed here, we've got the John Day River at the headwaters in the lower left corner. We have the coldest water quality standards that apply. So in that part, that goes from 12 degrees at the headwaters all the way down to 20 at the bottom. So for those of you that prefer graphs, this is what it looks like from headwaters to mouth. We start at the very cold waters at the headwaters. That's the 12 degrees in the bottom left of the graph. And as you go downstream, those temperatures increase according to the water quality standards that we set for different life stages of fish and how they use those waters during their life history. You'll also see that parallel line on top of it, and that is what we call the human use allowance. So we set values based on fish biology. That's that 12 degrees, 16, 18, 20 degrees. And then we have what's called the human use allowance, which is how we identify a minimum, that 0.3 degrees Celsius for that allows for a minimal impact from anthropogenic inputs of heat. So whether that's permitted discharges or landscape conditions that may result in some type of incremental addition of heat that we've, based on our work with EPA and based on fish biology and all that kinds of things, that we would conclude doesn't adversely impact those species that we're trying to protect. So that's what we're looking at when we go to the next step and trying to figure out whether or not we're achieving those water quality standards. And when we do that, we're looking at the numeric criteria and whether that numeric criteria is being achieved. And the way that we do that is we do what's called, we call it a call for data. So that call for data includes, of course, we've already got our own DEQ data, but we work really hard to cast a broad net to anybody else who may have relevant water quality data and information that we should use in evaluating whether or not waters are meeting water quality standards. In this last iteration that we just conducted last year in this call for data, we were able to obtain data from over 70 different organizations. And again, this is for many, many more pollutants than just temperature, but we had data from over 70 different organizations, everything from federal agencies to local governments, watershed councils, tribes. And we evaluated in the range of just under 7 million data points. So we try to do as comprehensive of a job as we can to try to pull in relevant data and information. We also do a quality check on that data to ensure it's of known quality, and there's a number of different ways that we conduct that, but we also look for quality data, and we also need to ensure that that data is relevant for the metrics that we're using to evaluate data. So in the case of temperature, I stuck that little graph up there to illustrate that for temperature, what we're looking for is continuous temperature data. That's the kind of data that we're looking for. It's most relevant when we're talking about temperature as opposed to grab sample, which we know there's diurnal fluctuations, all kinds of things with temperature that don't make grab sample data as a relevant and informative type of data to be able to use in these types of analyses. Well, in the case of the assessment as well, we're also going back about 10 years to look at available data to understand, get as kind of a comprehensive view as we can to ensure that it just wasn't an anomalous type of situation, but there is something that's occurring over time. And so as a result, what I've put here, this is still draft. We're in the process of finalizing all this information, but these are for temperature, the impairments that we identified as part of our draft report that we put out for comment last fall. So you'll see the purple, the bolded kind of purple squiggly lines. Those are the rivers, the larger rivers and streams that we have identified as impaired for temperature. And then you'll see kind of the purple blotches, which are those collections of smaller the smaller stream networks where there's in those areas there's one or more smaller streams that have an impairment in them. The green areas are where we, either the green lines or the green areas are where we have attainment of a temperature criteria. And in the yellow, those are areas where we don't have enough data to be able to draw a conclusion one way or another. So we've got some, but not enough to be able to draw conclusions. When we go to TMDL development, I just wanted to highlight, you know, these first few steps, we're talking about in-stream water quality data, and that's very important when we look at TMDLs, but we also look at other types of field collected data. So in addition to that continuous in-stream temperature data that we talk about, we also are looking for things like flow, habitat information, effective shade. We're also looking at remote sensing information, such as LIDAR, aerial photography, satellite imagery, other things like that. We're also pulling in literature, so that could be things like journal articles, agency report, those things that will help us understand conditions or desired conditions around vegetation, land management practices, landscape characteristics. We also try to build in local knowledge. So when we have advisory committees during our TMDL development process, we want people who are local landowners, members of city government, anybody who's relevant to that conversation to participate so that we can help us also build on this, either this scientific information with information that helps us put into context in the local landscape as we're doing our analyses. We use all of this information and various types of TMDL analyses, and also then do correlations of relevant data when we actually conduct our modeling, which pulls in all of this data and allows us to evaluate the information within the basin that we're working in. The scale of the TMDLs, I know we've heard a few different questions about how do we determine what is the scale of a TMDL. So one of the things is people are aware that we look at and develop a TMDL is based on a sub-basin scale. But a question we often get is, so where do the allocations apply? What meaning do they have? Where do they apply specifically on which river reaches? And what I wanted to highlight here was that, again, these purple lines are the areas in which we have impairments. And so as people probably also know, that pollutants flow downstream. And so heat is more readily gained than lost. It's easier to get heat into a system than out of the system. It does dissipate, and we look at that as part of our evaluation as well. But in order to achieve water quality within these impaired segments, we necessarily need to expand our analysis upstream of where those impairments are and allocate reductions in loading so that we can achieve water quality standards within those areas that we've affirmatively identified as not meeting water quality standards.
Just so when you're doing that, do you allocate proportional to load?
State Forester Doherty, if we can hold that question for a moment, I think I'll get to it. And if it doesn't, if I'm not answering your question, make sure to flag it and we'll get there. Because the next thing I wanted to, in two slides, we'll talk a little bit about how we get to loads. The first thing I wanted to just spend a moment talking about was I spent a little bit of time on maps and how we get information in the scale. But in terms of, you know, what are the steps involved to get to this place of having a completed TMDL, the first thing we're doing is, again, we've got the numeric criteria, which is at 12, 16, 18, 20 degrees. And then the standard also includes the numeric criteria plus that 0.3 degrees human use allowance. So those are those two parallel lines you see there. And in the case of an impairment, we have temperatures that exceed both of those values. So first we do an assessment of what is the current condition, by how much are we exceeding, what are, you know, what is that current water quality information that we have. And then we do source identification. So that involves looking at what does the landscape look like in this particular basin, who are the landowners, what abuts the riparian conditions, what contributors might things like flow or habitat alteration be in terms of contributors to what we're seeing in terms of current condition, what are the point sources, contributions, et cetera. So we do an evaluation of what, again, what is the current state, but looking at those different types of sources. And then we get to the allocation place. So first of all, what is the overall subtraction we need to make? What is actually occurring either in terms of natural background, you know, what would we expect to be there naturally? And then in the case of temperature, the thing that is a little bit special about this from other pollutants is then what we do is we focus the allocations around that 0.3 degrees. So that's the total. What we do is we allocate heat loads to ensure that that temperature isn't rising 0.3 degrees throughout in any one location throughout the basin. So when you actually look at the allocations, if you summed them up arithmetically, you would get to more than 0.3. But what that ensures is that for any point within the watershed, we're not getting a cumulative impact from those point sources of greater than 0.3 at any place within the watershed. I see nodding heads, so that looks like it makes sense. And so as we allocate that, we have what are called waste load allocations. Those go to point sources that get permits. Load allocations go to non-point sources. And then we're also required to save a little for potential growth in the future and save a little to account for potential uncertainty in some of the analyses that we have.
Yeah, so I still clear up my question. So the scale here is heat, not temperature, correct?
Correct. So our analyses go from in-stream temperatures. We do our analysis based on heat inputs, which cause those increases in temperatures. So a lot of our analysis, we talk about kilocalories. So we have a lot of talk about kilocalories. It isn't related to food and at DEQ. So we talk about heat inputs in terms of kilocalories. And then we do relationships. Neither one of those in terms of land management practices is really that relevant in terms of saying, so what does this mean to me in terms of what needs to change on the landscape? So we then translate that into metrics such as changes in flow or most relevant for this conversation, shade, which in many cases is the predominant, if not the most significant contributor, or the lack of shade, the significant contributor to the heat impacts that we're seeing in the streams and rivers that we're looking at.
Could I sort of follow up? The amount of heat load you create in changing temperature depends on the volume in a particular area. And so that gets back to my regular question. Do you allocate the overall load at some point based on the actual heat load that's being contributed opposed to so that they're, right?
Yeah, so State Forester Doherty, when we do those allocations and are looking at conditions, we in our evaluations, we're looking at flows. We're looking at critical times of year in particular because if you kill off all the fish in August, it doesn't matter what the water quality is in June. And so we're looking at ensuring that we're achieving the in-stream standards at those critical times of year. So we'll look at that confluence of what are those conditions. So sometimes flow can be more, we have to look at the confluence of flow, shade. You're going to probably, in some parts of the state, you'll have more shade in the summer, but if it's a largely deciduous versus conifer forest, you know, that changes, and that is critical, like August to October low flow months. So those are the kinds of data and information that we will put into our evaluation to understand what are the critical times of year, understanding what is that heat input relative to the flow, not just of the water body that we're of that's impaired, but also looking at heat times flow for those upstream delivery of water. So if there's very little water coming in upstream, the heat load that that can carry is necessarily going to be much less than a tributary that has much higher flows coming in from upstream. So we look at all those different factors, and that's where we pull in all of this data and information and look at literature and other state agencies' expertise and pull that in and conduct and correlate all that information through modeling that really can, that's the tool that enables us to be able to pull in all of those different variables and understand how best to look at all of that. Because it does, as you've, as is implied in your question, it becomes very important for how we're thinking about what is the effect of implementation actions and what are those allocations and what are the reasonable expectations or even the priorities that where we should be focused within that watershed to achieve, get the greatest gains in terms of water quality benefits for implementation actions on the ground.
And I might add, that's one of the critical questions that we're actually kind of digging through right now. And so trying to understand what that looks like is a critical piece of this whole thing. So.
Thanks. Yep. And this next slide too, one of the other things that we do, in addition to taking that analysis on the watershed scales, we also then try to overlay who are the responsible implementing agencies and jurisdictions that we need to be working with. So we do this kind of a mapping exercise, which tells us different types of landowners or sources that occur within a basin and the relevant either state agency, federal agency, or local entity that has the relevant water quality programs or jurisdiction to implement programs relevant to the TMDL. So this helps us understand, again, back to the allocation question, you know, who owns how much frontage as it relates to the streams. It also helps us understand, you know, this mapping exercise. We can also use this when we start talking about TMDLs. Again, back to priorities. This stream that I've got depicted here runs east-west. We may identify priorities and may focus more on those, the southern parts of the properties as opposed to the northern parts of the properties. That's a very simple example. But there's lots of different ways in which we would identify different attributes and aspects that will help both inform allocations and implementation actions on the ground that are going to have the largest return on efforts in any particular part of the watershed. Within each of the TMDLs I talked about, again, when we do a TMDL, we're starting from a desired in-stream temperature, talking about sources of heat loads and reductions that need to be made, and then ultimately working to translate that into shade. And so in our TMDLs, we do analyses around what is current condition, what would desired condition be, and being able to identify what are the targets that we're shooting for in a particular river and stream. This first example here, I'm going to show you, this is a creek where we look at, and I think we've mentioned the word system potential vegetation. That's a word that DEQ uses. As a general matter, what that means is it's not necessarily a pre-settlement type of condition. It's something, it's a term I've heard that seems to resonate in our conversations as a late successional type of forest, something that represents, the type of forest that one might find in that type of geography in the state. And so, and what kind of shade might that type of vegetation provide that stream for that stream. And so in this instance here, you're seeing this is from the 2008 TMDL, a comparison of the current condition at that time versus what we saw as the system potential. That system potential is fairly high compared to this next example, which is the Rogue River. And again, we would have different expectations in terms of what ultimately the shade targets that we'd be looking for in a Rogue River versus something like Elk Creek, just due to the nature of those systems. And so we've got that kind of information, and then we did demonstrate how that information looks in a variety of different ways within the TMDL. In some cases, we describe it as a percent effective shade target that is what we're shooting for as the ultimate goal of the TMDL outcome. We have other things in other TMDLs that are like lookup tables. So we look at desired shade that we're looking for based on a certain stream width in a certain part of the watershed. So there's a lot of different ways in which DEQ looks at that kind of information to try to make implementation targets more meaningful to people who are trying to think about how do we manage things on the ground. In terms of allocations themselves, you know, our general approach is to try to set milestones. It's not our expectation that once a TMDL is issued that those allocations are achieved tomorrow. Most of our TMDLs, especially when we're talking about temperature and shade, typically have time horizons around 30 years, recognizing that it both takes time to implement changes and for vegetation to grow. So that takes time, and that's the expectation. We do set milestones, and we also try to plan for adaptive management and build that in, knowing that our knowledge is not going to be perfect when we issue a TMDL. The Clean Water Act sets up a framework by which it really tries to, I think, incentivize the best information that we can bring into that analysis, but it doesn't give us really any latitude to delay developing these kinds of TMDL. We can't really delay them saying, oh, we need this much more information, but it does allow us to do adaptive management and revisit what's known, adjust our expectations and knowledge about effective forms of implementation to achieve those targets over time. And so, as you know, I think as everyone here is aware, how do we marry up this process with the forestry process is the topic of this conversation in this implementation space. The typical allocations that we do have related to non-point source, again, as I mentioned earlier, the allocations are intended to represent a not greater than 0.3 degrees Celsius impact at any point within the watershed. So typically for non-point sources, we're looking at impacts around the 0.1 degree or less degrees Celsius is typical of what we would have allocated actually for almost any source, point sources, non-point sources, counties, cities. They're all very small amounts of temperature. And so we do try to work it into things that kind of have a little bit more meaning. So what does that actually mean on the ground? And what are some of the outcomes that we would project would correlate with ensuring that we're not causing a greater than that amount of temperature impact on streams and rivers. The last thing I just want to highlight and then see if there's any additional questions is I mentioned adaptive management and then how do we know how things are progressing and how do we better inform what we know. One thing that DEQ has started doing is pulling together status and trend information. So again, it's just a little bit different way of harvesting all the data and information that exists out there, but what we've done is done statewide analyses like this where we look at different monitoring stations where we have data and we do called a spot check where we look at the last few years worth of data and go, how are we doing the last few years? And then if we have trending information, if we have enough data to be able to pull a trend and you'll see on some of those little, I don't know what they're called, the upside down raindrops there. You'll see arrows. And that tells us which way the data is trending, if there is a trend in the data. So that also helps us know maybe it's not achieving yet, but it's going in the right direction, or things have started to decline, and that can be kind of a trigger for looking a little bit closer at what might be have happened in the last several years to get a sense of where do we need to investigate further and get some understanding of where things are headed. And so this is information, in fact, that we've been using with the Department of Agriculture in their biennial review process, and that's actually how this effort got started, was being able to bring that kind of information into that conversation with the Department of Agriculture as they do the biennial reviews, and being able to say, here's what we know about what's happening on the ground, and so that can inform some of their planning processes. So that was my quick flyby.
A question on slide 8 on the development of temperature TMDLs. Are there instances where the excess load is all attributed to background natural sources?
Member Christofferson, I would say I would have to ask my analysts whether or not that's ever been the case. I think definitely we have identified cases where natural and background sources are significant. Whether or not the excess, whether we think there's, I would say it's unlikely that we would attribute all of the excess load to natural sources. Typically, when we go in and look at what's happened on the landscape, again, from whether it's permitted sources, land management activities, we are finding that those activities in total are also contributing to that excess load, and that there is some reductions that can be made from human caused sources of heat input. So typically, we're definitely seeing excess load from human sources as well.
Okay. I'm not trying to like complicate things. I'm just asking because, I've heard, I work in Eastern Oregon. I've worked there for 20 years, and I've heard people suggest that, some of the streams coming out of the wilderness areas in Eastern Oregon exceed these limits. Mm-hmm. And just curious then how mm-hmm. they would be characterized. Mm-hmm. And more important, I guess, to me would be, what are the downstream implications of that?
Mm-hmm. Member Christofferson, and so I think it's very challenging to look at temperature because you have not only inter-year variability, but within the year variability. And so, you know, the years that we often currently are benchmarking is anomalous years of 2015 and 2016. Maybe they're going to become more common. But in those years, when you have very warm years, it's highly likely that you're seeing streams, even in their natural state, that would exceed probably these temperatures. One of the things that we try to do to try to just bifurcate some of those issues and focus on what can be done is by taking this approach here, is we just try to focus on this piece of it. So if we can minimize the human caused inputs, that's going to be our focus. And if the natural is greater than that, we're not going to focus energy on trying to reduce that. But if we can focus on what do we know about what's causing additional heat into the system from human activity, let's focus our efforts and analysis there. And so then when we get those anomalous years, if they're greater than that, that is what it is, but we've mitigated the human parts of that.
Jennifer, thanks for coming. I asked Jennifer, she described a lot of this stuff to me after the EQC meeting, and a lot of stuff I didn't understand, I didn't know, and that's why I really asked Jennifer to come kind of dive a little bit deeper. Could you remind me again, just Jennifer, how long data is collected before an impairment decision is done? How many years of collection?
So in terms of how many years, we will use whatever information we've got, but we do have data minimums. I made myself a note in case I got this question. So we are looking for at least two instances of exceeding the it's a 7-day rolling average metric is what we use, and we're looking for at least two instances of exceeding that within a 3-year period. So if we only have one instance where it's been exceeded, then we would say it's insufficient data. And we also need at least 7 days of continuous data collected, of course, to be able to do that metric. There's a lot of data that we have that are for shorter durations, and so we don't use that data.
Other questions? I think that it was really helpful to have you walk through this. I guess just to step back from it a little bit, how are you both feeling about how we're doing in terms of our timeline for this broader process? And
That's a fair question. So I think, you know, things are tight for the July sufficiency decision, and I think we both of our agencies know that. We've recently just hired a facilitator to kind of help speed that process along to some degree. They'll help us focus on the questions that are most important moving forward for July and kind of leave some of the stuff that we don't need to have right now, but will be important for the larger process. So to answer your question, I think we're doing okay. I think, you know, we've got significant buy-in from the board and the EQC and the directors, you know, and we've had a significant effort from our staff to get these things kind of moving forward, producing our mutual vision and mission for this work. So I'm feeling pretty good about it.
I would agree. I know our agency is committed to supporting the process in whatever way we need to so that we can arrive at the schedule that the board has set out for a sufficiency determination by July. So, you know, we're committed to being able to do that work. And I echo Kyle's sentiments in terms of one of the things that actually was my takeaway from our first meeting that included the facilitator was hopeful on her abilities to focus on. It'd be wonderful if we could understand everything about each other's program and knit it together in this perfect little sweater. But, but that knowing what, being able to cut the wheat from the chaff, so to speak, and what is on our essential critical pathway to, getting from here to there, and ensuring that we have those essential conversations and figure out what space do we have for the things that help build our broader understanding and working relationship over time.
Good. That's great. Well, appreciate this working relationship that's developed through this too. I think it's really helpful to both our agencies' boards.
Thank you.
Thank you.